In the fabled land of Northern California, nestled in the Valley of Sacramento, two friends begin a journey to enlighten the world about their experience living life as a Xennial. But what is a Xennial, you may ask? If you wish to know, then follow them on their adventures.
Welcome to the Xennial Chronicles. This is James.
This is Mike.
And guess what? We're back after our 1 week hiatus because of people throwing up.
I blacked out. What happened?
People threw up.
Oh.
I didn't come here.
Yeah.
We posted a video with me in my loft saying, hey, we're not doing a video because people are throwing up.
Yeah.
Actually, I just said it was a stomach flu, but people were throwing up.
Well, I mean, that has to do with the stomach.
It was horrifying.
I bet.
Baby queens blowing chunks everywhere.
God.
Movie reference. Sorry. It's a good movie. Can't think of the name of it right now. Drop Dead Gorgeous. That's what it is. Drop
Dead
Gorgeous.
Oh, is that the one? Oh, yes. Okay, yeah. Oh,
watch
man.
It. Hidden,
it's an old movie. It's 20
hidden
years
gem.
Old, man.
Yeah, it's a late 90s movie. Kirsten Dunst, yeah. Kirstie Alley, other people with weird names like that. but no, it's a great movie, kind of hidden gem movie that most people, it's funny, humorous. It's one of those early kind of documentary style type movies.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it kind of became, you know, Blair Witch Project did their thing and then other people tried it. But this is a full on comedy about a beauty pageant in like this small town in Minnesota. We've talked about it a little bit before.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know that you have to see it again. I know you watched it when you were living with me like years ago as a roommate.
It's been a while.
But you have to watch it again because to see the people in it, so funny. So funny.
You know what? I ended up finding it, not Drop Dead Gorgeous. We don't have that one. But there was another film.
Did you get Josie?
Finally? No. Okay. I got different. I got one that we watched together.
What?
American Dreams.
American Dreams.
It's the one that's got Mandy Moore in it. That's the super twisted, super dark take on American Idol.
I don't remember watching that with you.
Oh, dude, it's crazy dark, super crude humor.
I don't think I watched that with you.
It's really, really dark. I'll have you borrow it. Okay. I found it was like in a bargain bin for like $3 at a Walmart or something like that. I just remembered seeing it and going, oh my God, honey, you have to see. My wife was with me. I was like, you have to see this. This is so not what you would expect. It looks like at the cover, it just looks like a blockbuster B movie.
Yeah.
It totally looks like that. And then you watch it and all the people that are in it and it is super messed up. It's wonderful.
Well, you know,
Dennis Quaid's in it, and he plays like a parody of George W. Bush in it. They get the president involved in the middle of this stuff.
I like it.
It's so funny. It's so great.
See, that's one of the reasons I like Drop Dead Gorgeous. If you remember anything at all from it, is it makes you, it's a movie that seems to be just about doing a documentary on a beauty pageant.
Yeah,
and then like about 2/3 of the way into the movie, you think it's even more than that. You think it's over because the beauty pageant is basically over.
Yeah.
And then it takes a left turn and then it takes a right turn and then it hits a dead end and falls off a cliff. And like, especially the fall off the cliff moment, you're watching it and you're going, all right, this is happening. This, what the hell just happened?
Oh, that's right.
It's one of those, it's one of those moments.
This time, Chris Klein is in
it.
He's in it. He plays a war veteran. Who's one of the contestants?
Okay,
falls in love with Mandy Moore's character.
I don't
Things
remember
get
this,
weird.
But
it's
this all
funny.
Makes this all makes me so interested.
Yeah,
because I just the juxtaposition of people is going to be fun.
Yeah,
to be able to see. Anyway, back to why we're here to have another podcast after 2 weeks of being off. Things have happened in these 2 weeks.
A little bit.
There's a couple of things I wanted to talk to you specifically about.
Okay.
You know, you're such a music guy.
I'm into it, yeah.
There's been an announcement. There's been announcements in the last 2 weeks about two bands kind of getting back together.
Yes. I know who you're talking about.
The first one, goth and emo children of the world can be happy. My Chemical Romance is doing shows again. They are getting back together. That's kind of, I mean, I know and live with a few My Chemical Romance fans. I actually like a few of their songs personally. I think they their song The Black Parade, I think, was an attempt at trying to make a modern day version, at least when they came out, a modern day version of Bohemian Rhapsody. I don't think it fully succeeded, but it's a great song.
They've been from what I have known of them, I am not super into them. The things that I've caught from them, though, there was some stuff that they did what was the one that I really liked? Probably the one that I really liked more than anything was, I think it's Helena.
Yes.
It's the one after his named after his grandmother.
I don't know what it's I don't know who it's named after, but I know that song. That's one
of my
favorite songs.
That's a good song. That's probably like, I know a lot of people really like, they tend to gravitate towards that as one of MCR's best songs.
Yeah, that's one of my
favorites.
I like
that song. I never was really into MCR, but I never really like listened to their stuff.
That song is a little hard to sing. I will say that. There's some high notes in that damn song.
Cool.
It's on one of the singing games that I have. The SingStar games.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's I can do it, but it's the notes are very high. They hurt.
Okay.
They cause me pain. But anyway. We have some people, like I said, I have some people I know that are really excited to see them coming back. Hopefully they're going to do more. Right now they've just said they're going to do a couple of reunion shows,
mm-hmm.
but it would be nice maybe to see if them put out some more music. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
I know the lead singer Gerard Way, he's actually been involved in comic books since they stopped having the band.
He writes,
I believe he writes and draws his own comic books.
That's cool, man.
But he's totally huge, huge into comic books. And then the other one, which I think has a little more meaning for you and I personally.
Yes.
You know which one I'm talking about, right?
Oh, yes. I know. I've been waiting for this one. I've been waiting for it. I've been waiting for it to happen. I knew it was going to happen again. Do you want me to say it?
Say it,
oh,
sir.
Oh, dude, Rage Against the Machine is finally getting back
wow.
together.
Wow. It's, I mean, the only thing
I think what are they doing is the last time they got together, they headlined Coachella, like in 2010?
Ooh. Ooh.
What if 2011?
What if they get together, they do a couple of festival shows, like, I don't know, one that happens in Sacramento next fall?
I would be shocked if they did that.
Well, I'm just saying, if they're the headliner on Saturday night,
mm-hmm.
just for people who don't know, it's the Aftershock Festival. Happens every year,
man,
at Land Park in the Sacramento area. And at the Aftershock Festival this next year, 2020, Metallica will be headlining Friday night and Sunday night, and we'll be playing two separate sets on each night, so a different set each night.
Yeah.
But they have not announced who will be, first of all, they haven't announced any of the other bands. But moreover, they have not announced who will be headlining on Saturday night.
Yeah.
Again, Metallica Friday, Metallica Sunday, no Saturday night yet.
Right. There isn't a major Saturday night headliner yet. But I will
Wouldn't
tell you
that
this.
Wouldn't
that
be
like,
cool if it was Rage? All I can say is anybody who's bought tickets or buying tickets for that would really be excited if Rage was playing that show. I'm just saying.
But I think they're gonna, if that's the case and they play something like Aftershock, a festival like that, they are really going to surprise. It's funny, but they're really going to surprise a lot of people. I think
I almost had a chance to see them back in the 90s.
God, that would have been amazing.
I was one of those kids. I was a dumb kid. I was too worried about my job that I ended up leaving anyway. And a buddy of mine was like, "Dude, I have tickets to go see Rage Against the Machine," and it was not. It wasn't even like in a stadium. It was like a concert hall. So it was a smaller venue. And it was like, I got tickets. You want to go with me? I said, no, man. I got to go to work. I went to work instead of seeing Rage.
That's literally as opposite.
Do you know how much that hurts?
That's as far removed from going to see a Rage concert
as you possibly could be. I know. It's like, what, you even thought about going to work?
Working in a corporate-level job.
You have no right to be at a Rage concert. Right. I don't.
Hey, we've all mistakenly made those sacrifices.
Yeah,
so.
I missed the first Metallica symphony. Back 20 years ago, because I didn't go and get a ticket immediately because I was too worried about other people involved with me at the time.
So you're saying that if they happen to play that Saturday, that it's going to essentially be like a double.
It'll be a double shot for anybody who didn't get to see Metallica.
A double
at the
retribution for your suffering over the past 20 years or so.
I'm not saying I have tickets to Aftershock. I'm not saying I don't. But I'm not saying I do.
I'm saying I don't. But man, but, I'm not saying that it's not justifiable. I'm just saying I just don't have that kind of money.
I understand that. That's a consideration.
It's to anybody who can afford to go. It's worth it. Go.
The fact that you could see two different sets from Metallica, you're talking at least what do you figure in a set for Metallica? Between 8 and 12 songs?
At least, yeah.
I'd say so.
And you're not gonna see the same set twice, but you'll hear some of the, probably half the set is gonna be the same songs.
Completely separate set each night.
What?
Friday night one set, Sunday night a different set. Completely separate songs both nights.
Oh man, that means they're skipping out like that's gonna be like a set where they're skipping out on Enter Sandman. That's gonna be weird.
That's fine.
It's just gonna be weird because it's like a staple. Yeah. I'm not saying that you have to hear it. Like if you go see Metallica, you're gonna hear Enter Sandman.
But
this means there's gonna be a set where if you go see Metallica, you're not gonna hear Enter Sandman one of those nights.
There should be three songs you hear every time you see Metallica play. Okay. You should hear Enter Sandman.
Okay.
Typically. You should hear one, and you should hear Master of Puppets. Those are like the three songs you're gonna hear no matter what.
Absolutely, 100%. They're songs you should hear every set.
They're
songs
that
you will hear, songs that you should hear, and songs that, like you should be able to hear Fade to Black.
Having seen Metallica three times, I've only heard Fade to Black played live once.
Is that the same show that I went with you?
No, Fade to Black wasn't played that night.
No.
No, the time I heard Fade to Black was in the original...
They played Bread Fan, though.
I heard it in the original Summer Sanitarium tour. Mm-hmm. I was standing on the field at Candlestick Park, mm-hmm. when Candlestick Park still existed in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they played... That's when they played, or I heard them play live, Fade to Black. It's the only time I've heard them do Fade to Black.
I could have sworn they played Fade to Black.
I don't remember them playing Bread Fan at the show in Sacramento.
Yeah, I remember there were just like... Bread Fan is Budgie, right?
Yes, Bread Fan is Budgie.
I remember they specifically named it, and I remember looking straight at you because we didn't expect to hear it.
You know what? You're right. Because the first time
because as soon as he said Budgie, we looked at each other like, no way, dude.
It was because the first concert I saw them at was at Cal Expo.
Yeah.
In 98, mm-hmm. I believe. And it was 98. It was September of 98. I saw them at Cal Expo, and they opened with Bread. Well, I mean, they opened with Ecstasy of Gold, obviously.
Yeah.
But then the second Ecstasy of Gold cut off, the very second, it went right into the riff of Bread Fan.
Cool.
Which is like, if you don't know Bread Fan, it's one of those galloping riffs that like you just want to hear and want to move to.
Oh yeah.
And it just started
immediate mosh pit music.
Yeah, just to start up that riff, and it was just like, oh my god, this is amazing.
Yeah.
This is so cool.
That's dope, man.
But okay. Speaking of Metallica, though.
Oh, we are continuing.
After our actually the day before our last podcast came out, because our last podcast came out on Halloween.
Yes.
The day before that, Mike and I had a little date night. And yes, I'm going to call it that.
Mandate.
We went to the movie theaters see the Metallica Symphony.
Yeah, S&M 2.
The S&M 2 at the theater, the concert film, which will be, I'm sure, going out for DVD, Blu-ray, whatever, for people to buy.
I was going
to
say, it's going to be within the next month. They make the album announcement after the end of the credits.
Yeah.
So I knew that. I'm going to find it. I'm going to Blu-ray it. I'm going to get whatever edition of it. It was, I loved it.
Well, it was the second time you got to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But
first time I got to see it with a decent mix, because the first time I went...
Well, you were sitting to one side, weren't you?
We were sitting in the back in one side, and the way that they mix it, so they mix the whole thing in like 7.1 or 5.1.
So yeah,
the
so crowd's behind
you,
sound.
The band's in front of you, James's vocal is front center, all the vocals are top center. James's guitar is on the left, Kirk's is on the right, everybody kind of knows that, but the drums are center surrounded.
Yeah.
So they're kind of in the back along with the symphony, and the symphony's out, and like all that kind of stuff. And the crowd's behind you. Well, the problem is when you get a guitar solo kicked in, that guitar solo gets, instead of what they normally do with like a stereo mix, engineer guy, right? I listen to this stuff.
I'm sitting here listening to the engineer talking.
Okay.
So,
engineer stuff. So when you hear a stereo Metallica album, what happens is they'll take Kirk's guitar, bump it up a couple dB, and throw it in the center. Right?
dB being decibels.
dB means decibels. Yeah, dB is the measurement of sound level. So, and then James' guitar stays where it's at, chills in the back, over on one side.
Yeah.
And then Kirk's guitar goes back into its spot. And they do that every time. There's actually, like, every time you see them live, you will hear it that way. What they did this time was they made sure that James and Kirk were very... out
separate
and separate. They didn't put Kirk's guitar into the middle, what they did, because there were so many other elements, they didn't want to put anything in the center because some of the symphony is in the middle and it's all surrounding. So what they did was they just cranked the living hell out of Kirk's guitar out of all of the speakers on one side.
Okay, that makes sense. I was wondering why it did sound a little bit strange when that
and
happened.
And I was sitting in the back on the back right side, on Kirk's side. Every time there was a guitar solo, there was a speaker probably about 10 feet away from me.
So it was just blasting.
And it just destroyed my ears on one side of my head. I was like, I didn't know I was supposed to bring earplugs to a movie experience.
But of course, I made sure we got seats in the middle.
Oh, and it sounded fantastic. Yeah, that's why I was telling you, get center seats. Get the middle of the theater. Do not go anywhere else. Otherwise, you won't hear it right.
Well, and I did get center seats. And it was amazing.
And it was amazing.
But here's one of the fun stories of this.
Okay.
First of all, it was a great show. Mm-hmm. It was great to watch.
Yeah.
I fell in love with another one of Kirk Hammett's guitars, that sparkly purple Ouija board guitar.
Yeah.
That thing is beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
I've been told that I'm not allowed to buy it. It will happen one day. But right now, I'm not allowed to buy it. But it is a beautiful guitar. But we're watching this. It goes to the intermission point in the concert, uh-huh, which is not an intermission in the theater. We're still there. The intermission only lasts like 30 seconds or so at most.
Uh-huh.
And it goes into the second half of the concert, mm-hmm, right? Lars comes out, and he's doing some talking. As Lars is doing some talking, at one point he's got kind of his left hand up, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And you see on screen a woman in kind of a tie-dye shirt, which was one of the shirts that they had sewn at the event. Tie-dyed shirt, stand up. As this happens, the woman sitting next to Mike in the theater exclaims loudly, "Oh my God, that's me! You're right, that's me!" We're like, "What the hell?"
Yeah. Did you hear her talking about it before the film started? Because I was sitting right next to her.
No, did you?
Yeah. She was sitting next to her sister, yeah, and her sister's like, "Yeah, you're in this one shot. It's right when Lars is talking about this thing over here, and you're right there in the background."
Oh, so you had heard about this all before.
Yeah, so I'm looking for it. I'm waiting for it because I heard them talking about it. And so
she makes this exclamation. It's like, "What the hell?" We lean over to talk to her, and she's like, "Yeah, I was there. Look, I'm there in the thing." And sure enough, yeah, it's her.
She's wearing the same T-shirt. Yes. At that theater performance that they did the show, yeah, like she's wearing the same T-shirt at that show as she was sitting next to us, so it was like plain as day. You could absolutely see it was her,
and that's the coolest thing ever.
Oh yeah, dude,
it
that was
really
fun.
Is as I explained to Mike with his previous band Prilosis, I tried to get in a bunch of the videos for it. I offered any time they did a video, I'd get in the damn video just so I could be in it. My leg is in a video, but just my leg.
You were part of our advertisements, though.
Because I have sexy legs. Where was I part of the advertisements?
You advertised our, I believe.
I remember for one of your shows in downtown Sacramento, mm-hmm, I spent 2 hours running around downtown Sacramento in the K Street Mall handing out flyers before the show.
Yes, there was that one.
Yeah.
God, wow, yeah.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was a while back. I could have swore that you were in one of our ads, or maybe it's no. You know what it was? You know what it was? We just posted pictures of you with the tattoos.
You probably just
and the
showed
shot
the tattoos
glasses.
Tattoos and the shot glasses. So my tattoos get in the promotions, not me. Great, but anyway, it was just the coolest thing. So we actually made sure to take a picture outside the theater with her afterwards, just because that's really cool to have somebody that was there at. I have other friends that were there at the show.
Yeah,
but just to randomly have a person there in the theater, in the movie theater with us, watching herself be in the show. That's really cool. It's kind of a neat little spark of things. And yes, by the way, for anybody that is a Metallica fan that didn't get to go to that concert, get the movie when it comes out on DVD and Blu-ray, get the CD of it. It's really well done. There are some surprising songs in there that are just, they do a couple that I'm glad they did. Like, I don't think this is giving away because they did it on the first one, but Outlaw Torn is one of my favorite Metallica songs.
Yeah.
And the fact that they did it again, and you're not often going to get a chance to hear Outlaw Torn live. Mm-hmm. Again, it would be cool if it was done at Aftershock for anybody that goes. But having that one done is great. But the couple other they did, they do a different version of one of their songs that is, I would say, not necessarily one of their popular songs, although it's had new meaning over the last so many years. But yeah, the version that they do of it is amazing.
Yeah,
it really makes
they've
the
done
song.
They've done some rewrites of some of the stuff on. We're specifically talking about the Saint Anger album.
Yes.
Everybody that you know that listens to music hates that album, and I understand rightfully
actually,
so.
Actually, there's a couple of songs on it I like.
Right, but the album itself was very
overall the
blown
the album
apart
was
and just not.
Yeah.
It was very, yeah, it was, I always consider that the album was not an album so much as it was a cleansing process.
Yeah.
There's a difference. It's a documentary.
The documentary shows
that. And it shows, yeah, these guys are in shambles, they're in pieces, and they're just trying to do something. Because once you accomplish that, you can then move forward and improve.
Yeah.
And so I understand that.
And the next album after that was awesome.
Yes, it was.
I definitely could say I like Death Magnetic a lot more than the current album. I'm still trying to get myself into the current album.
I'm surprised at. I think the current album there's a lot of really good material on
there's it. There's good stuff. It's just I haven't been able to get myself into it the way that I did Death Magnetic. Although, you know, I probably should.
But the
before the fall.
What we're talking about is, I mean, it's not like I'm necessarily spoiling anything. It's a musical performance, not a movie.
I guess.
But the one that we're talking about is there was a rework of the song All Within My Hands, which is the album ender on Saint Anger. They actually rework it into an acoustic type version, but they rearrange the entire song to where it's much better formed.
Yeah.
In general, melodically, it feels a lot better, especially if you know what the subject matter is behind the song.
Well, now what it's come to mean
that much more important.
What it's become, because All Within My Hands is their charitable foundation that they do now. So the changing of it, especially there's some darker elements in the original song. And so,
well, they didn't change the lyrics or anything. It's the same lyrics, but you can't necessarily.
They removed the kill, 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 kill.
Well, yeah, but that's because of the right. Well, it's like they added it on to the end of it just for the hell of it. Like it didn't really work.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's they at least removed those elements from it.
Well, the other lyrics that are there, you know,
the other lyrics,
love is control. I'll die if I let go.
The other lyrics make sense and work with it. It's just that last part really doesn't work for a charitable foundation.
Well,
you don't want your theme song of a charitable foundation to have kill, 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 kill.
No, of course not.
Kill, kill.
Well, the upper.
Really. Really, it's just that there's some things you don't want it with connected
some of
to
the
a charitable
smartest
foundation.
Lyrics that I've ever heard are written in that song. Like that bridge section is something that always hits me. I will only let you breathe the air that you receive, then we'll see if I let you love me.
Yeah,
that is dark.
Well, no, actually, that's
and it's deep at the same time.
Well, no, one of the things that I think is really good about that album, in specific, as much as it is a maligned album,
mm-hmm.
is some of the lyrics and some of the songs in there, just lyrically,
mm-hmm.
are really deep,
yeah.
and have really good meaning. You know, really good purpose to them. Sweet Amber is one that I really love.
Yeah,
I love that song. Throw a solo on that song and it's perfect.
Yeah,
but it's the lyrics and the meaning behind that. You know, scratch your back so you won't stab mine.
Yeah,
and then seeing that moment come up in the documentary where he comes up with that line, it's mm-hmm. just amazing.
That was
so
cool
there's
too.
Some gems within that.
Like that live. They started working in a guitar solo in the bridge section of Frantic. It actually makes it much more digestible. I would consider
that would make it more digestible. Yes,
mm-hmm.
I would agree 100% with that.
Yeah,
but
I like it. But anyways,
anyway, it was a good concert film.
Yeah,
good concert film. Again, more surprises. We gave away we said about the All Within My Hands, but there's a couple more surprising songs. One specifically that I mean, okay, I will admit I'm a crier. I cry at things all the damn time.
Right.
There are movies that I still every time I watch, I cry at the damn movie.
Yeah.
There was a moment there in the theater I cried. There was a song that made me
Which
cry.
Which was it?
You want me to reveal it?
I'll tell you mine.
Unforgiven 3.
That was good.
I was bawling for that. And yes, Unforgiven 3 is on there for those who know that song.
That was really good.
And, okay, I'll spoil it since it's already been out.
Mm-hmm.
It's just James Hetfield singing with the orchestra. Nobody else on, none of the rest of Metallica on stage. Just James Hetfield singing. And it is brutal and powerful and emotional. And
because
that song is already, I mean, The Unforgiven songs are kind of have an interesting take to them, but I think in this way, or in this song, Unforgiven 3, I think it's the most personal of them, because it's literally, you know, why can't I forgive me?
Yeah.
That line in there, that for anybody that's felt that they the things that they've done wrong in life, for anybody that feels they have regrets, sometimes the hardest thing, and I wouldn't say actually not even sometimes, the hardest thing to do typically is forgive yourself for what's been done, for the things that you have done, and trying to find that way to forgive yourself and that redemption within yourself. And honestly, it's the most important thing. If you can't forgive yourself, how can you accept forgiveness from anybody else? Such a powerful song, and the way he delivers that song. But let me guess, yours is
Anesthesia.
Yeah, bass solo take two.
Yep. It was so good. It wasn't just good. It was a proper homage. It was exactly what
For those of you who don't know, Anesthesia is a bass solo that was done on the first album.
Yep.
That was done by the original recording bassist, let me add, Cliff Burton.
Yeah. Because
there was a bassist before him, but he wasn't a part of any of the recording sessions or any of that.
He actually said something recently, this week. Every time Metallica comes out with something major, somebody tries to get a hold of Ron McGovney about something. And he actually said that he does not regret leaving the band simply for the fact that he was just like, dude, I couldn't stomach what they did. It's not that he didn't like them. It's that he couldn't handle the lifestyle.
The lifestyle.
And it wasn't like, and he's not talking about like alcoholism. He's like, I'm not cut for that mold. I'm not the touring musician. I'm not the he's like, I'm super proud of them. They're amazing people, and they do so much, and they just don't stop. He's like, I couldn't stomach doing that.
Which is, I mean, that's good awareness on a guy. That's good awareness of himself.
The fact that he is able to put out that amount of respect.
Well, a good person that wishes them well for what they did, for what they're doing. That's good.
Yeah.
But anyway, Cliff Burton died in, what, 87, 88?
86. It was the year that Master of Puppets came out.
Did it come out in 86?
Yeah, okay. It was 83, Kill 'Em All. It was 83, 85, and 86?
I thought it was 87. But anyway, mid to late 80s, Cliff Burton had died in a bus accident.
Yep.
If you don't know the story, just go and research it. It's a pretty messed up story. But as a result, there are songs that didn't get played for many years.
Yeah.
With their next bassist, Jason Newsted, there were things that either he wasn't unable to play
right.
or just didn't play because the rest of Metallica wouldn't let him.
Right.
With their current bassist, when Robert Trujillo came into the band, there's a few things they started allowing being played, like Orion was played again, which was, for the most part, mostly put together by Cliff Burton. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But Anesthesia was never played by anybody because it was Cliff's thing. It was literally a bass solo that about two-thirds of the way through the bass solo, the drums kick in.
Yeah.
And then it's just drums and bass.
Yeah.
Well, one of the bass players, upright bass players from the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra Mike, I think, wants to talk about this. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, please. I actually did a bit of reading on this because I really wanted to see what was going on, what brought him to it.
Yeah.
And so the name of the bassist, his name is Scott Pingle.
Okay.
And he is the first bassist of the symphony orchestra.
He sits what will be like first chair.
Yeah, he's a first chair. He's a first chair bassist. And essentially the idea was that he had done some research and found that Cliff was very much into classical music in general.
Actually, if you really pay attention to things like Orion, because Orion and even Call of Cthulhu, because Cliff had a hand in writing both of those.
Yeah.
You see a lot of classical elements in the way that those are written, the way that those are layered together.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff that happened, especially on those first three on Ride the Lightning and on Master of Puppets.
Yes.
A lot of that had a lot of classical musical overtone in it from Cliff.
Yeah, absolutely. And the catch of this, basically what happened was he had done his research and found out a lot about, quite a bit about Cliff, and there were some things that Cliff used to do. Even like on tour, he'd piss off the rest of the guys because, the driver had the driver had control of the stereo. So when he's in the driver's seat, he's popping in. Everybody else is popping in, like, Diamond Head and
Misfits
and all this kind of stuff. He pops in, he throws in Bach and Mozart.
yeah,
and stuff. Like, so he was really into it, and like you said, it very much shows in his writing. Well, Scott knew this, so he kind of came up with an idea, and he went out and he bought an electric bass, an electric stand-up bass,
yeah,
and a mess of pedals, and went to the guys, which is like, he went and he bought the stuff and he learned how to do it. And then he pitched the guys, you know, he pitched to Lars and James. He's like, hey, I've got an idea about this.
Just from a novice musician to somebody who I would say is much more, schooled in musicianship, much more of a instrument player than me. You play guitar way more and way better than I do. To play any song that's a rock song on a stringed instrument that does not have frets,
yeah,
is already a difficult proposal.
But
to try to take something that is played on a bass guitar and at the speed at which that song is played, and then transfer that to an upright bass
on a bow, with not a bow, using with, your fingers, yeah, with using a bow.
You're using the bow and having a completely fretless neck on it.
Yeah.
That's some scary good stuff.
It is. And there's guys that have done this type of stuff before. The band Apocalyptica was made famous by playing Metallica's music with
their
cellos.
Their very first album was Four Cellos Do Metallica.
Yep. That was it. Very, very simple.
I remember
it was a simple concept, but when you look at it in execution, it is not.
But even then, a cello is a lot smaller neck to work with than even an electric upright bass. That's some hardcore stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And there have been rock musicians who have used upright basses for various things.
Mm-hmm.
Most famously, Peter Steele using a chain strap a upright bass on and play it like a regular bass. But when you're like 6'5", you can do whatever you want, basically.
Right.
But anyway, back to this gentleman.
This guy puts together a pedal configuration setup and
to try to mimic the distorted sound. And
yeah.
And
he does it with an electric bass rather than a It's very important that he used an electric bass as opposed to a standard hollow body bass that he electrified, because you would get a completely different tone out of it. Yeah. It sounded exactly like what
he's trying to get as close
intended
to the tone of an
electric bass, of
a rock electric bass with the upright.
Yep, an upright, you know, traditional classical bass. And so he gets a hold of the guys and was like, "Hey, I want to try something. I want to show you something." So James and Lars go into the room, or the rest of the – I'm pretty sure all the guys are watching. And he turns around. He does this thing and shows them what he's – you know, this is my plan. This is what I want to do. And they're like – they stop. They just stop dead in their tracks. They're just like, this is going in the show. Like,
well, yeah.
This is absolutely – like, this is unquestionably fantastic, and we want to do it. Let's do it. Let's make it happen. And then they work around with Lars as well, and – partway through the performance, what they do is part two of Anesthesia is Lars starts jamming on bass, or Lars starts jamming on the drums.
Yeah.
Lars came in for the live show and played the second half with this guy. And it was just, dude, it was everything you could expect it to be better.
That was kind of the moment I was waiting for as he's playing it. I'm like, all right, are they going to do this right? And he's getting to that point, and I'm like, oh, wait, they are. Because you see Lars come out, and Lars just starts on the drums. And again, for somebody who... you know, I can remember back the first time that I had Kill 'Em All as an album.
Yeah.
You know, I was introduced by Load and Reload to Metallica. But when I bought Load and Reload, I went back and I bought all the other albums. Now, I'd heard a lot of Ride the Lightning as a kid. And anybody who listened to the radio in the early 90s heard most of the Black album over and over again.
Yeah, for sure.
But I hadn't heard a whole lot from Kill 'Em All. And I'd only heard really Master Puppets from Master Puppets.
Yeah.
So I went back and listened to everything. And the first time as you're listening through, because back then, kids, we listened to the entire album. Even though we got it on CD, we would listen to the whole album and not just skip songs. Because you never know what hidden gems you could find. And when that song first came on, you hear that bass solo, take one. It's like, okay. And you hear this bass just start wailing and you're going, damn, I thought bass was just like the crappy backing music for everything. That's just the guy keeping rhythm with the drummer so the guitarist can do all the cool stuff.
Yep.
Unless you're like Les Claypool and bass is the only instrument that you hear in the band. And then weird lyrics about beavers. But You know, you,
yeah, that kind of sums up Primus pretty much for the most part.
Pretty much. but to hear that, to hear somebody be able to do
that
on bass guitar.
No insult to Primus,
that
stuff is awesome.
No, Les Claypool was told that he was too good a bassist to play in Metallica, actually, when he auditioned for them.
What was the video, the behind the music on? He's like, Diamondhead, who's that? I don't know who that is. You guys know any Isley Brothers tunes? Like,
yeah, just not the right fit.
We're like,
but anyway,
this isn't gonna work.
But anyway, to hear that was just an amazing thing, and then to see this concert video of this guy doing it, just really good. Harken back to the musicianship of Cliff Burton, just an amazing musician. One of those people, you know, they always talk about people that are lost too young as musicians, and I don't know. Each person, I guess, has their personal opinion mm-hmm. on which ones are real losses. Like, you know, Morrison from The Doors. In my opinion. I'm not a
really?
Huge Doors fan. I mean, I like him to some extent, but I don't see anything so transcendently great from The Doors. And moreover, any future of transcendently great.
The Doors were essentially charisma set to music. That was their deal.
Yeah, and that's why I'm saying, what have we lost? I'm not
you
sure
mean
that,
in the death
by,
of Jim Morrison
by the
in
death
general?
Of Jim Morrison, what more might he have done that we've really lost out on? See, that's where I come with it. I don't know that he would have done more. I do feel the same way for and this one's going to get me a lot of people upset with me. I feel the same way with Kurt Cobain.
Really?
He's the big death of our generation. But like I don't know. We don't lose Kurt Cobain. We don't get the Foo Fighters. And I happen to be a fan of the Foo Fighters. I think Dave Grohl's made some of the best music of his career by himself. Or at least after,
I can agree with that.
After Nirvana.
I can agree with that to a degree. Yes, I can agree with that to a degree. But
I just don't know how much more Kurt...
I
don't know how much more Kurt could have given us. You know what I mean? I don't know what more he would have done. Would he have given us more, or would he have just flamed out after the grunge movement had dissipated? Would he have come back? I mean, he would have come back maybe now when you see some resurgence of that stuff. I mean, take a band like
let's think about this for a minute. If we're gonna go onto that, like, I would actually like to have a pretty in-depth conversation.
Then let's take a break.
Okay,
let's take a break right
now.
Yeah,
that sounds great.
Because
I
more
have a few conversation things to say about that kind of stuff for sure.
Okay, and we'll have a few more. There's a few more musicians' deaths that I would like to discuss, and then heck, this leads into another new development. There's an actor who died young, who apparently there's talk about bringing a CGI version of this actor into a new movie.
Oh, I've heard about this.
So we can maybe discuss that a little if we get time in the second half.
Yeah.
All right, we'll take a break right now. We'll be back in just a minute.
Hey friends, this is Mike from the Xennial Chronicles reminding you to subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Zenchron, spelled Xenchron, to keep up to date on all things TXC. And please check out our official website, thezennialchronicles.com, or if that's too much to type, zenchron.com. Thanks again for listening, and now, back to the show.
Welcome back, everybody. So we're going to continue our conversation about musicians who died young and whether they would have had further contribution or not. I mean, obviously I'm sparking something with you, Mike, with my dissertation on Kurt Cobain.
Yes.
Which is to be expected. Again, from our generation, Kurt Cobain was like a spokesman of the people in many ways. And again, I don't know. I've always been concerned about the fact that I don't know what more we would have gotten out of him. And then to have lost possibly Foo Fighters as a result, I like what Dave Grohl has done musically. Plus, who Dave Grohl is as a person, he's a pretty cool dude from what I understand. Mm-hmm. Everything that's said about him, all the stories that are said about him, he's cool to his fans, he's cool to the people he works with.
Oh, yeah, the guy's an incredible person.
So, I mean, would we have lost that person, that version of Dave Grohl, if Kurt had stayed around? I'm not saying that if it was possible for another human being to live and not die, that I would just rather the person die. At least not in this case. I'm not saying that. I might say that in a different case, but I'm not saying that necessarily. I'm just saying, what could Kurt have given us? People talk so big about Kurt having died and how big a thing that was. And again, anytime any person dies, it is. But did we really lose this great poet, or just somebody that maybe had done all they needed to for music? Moreover, if he hadn't died, would his music still be as big as it is today? Or would it have just fallen by the wayside as another grunge band that didn't mean anything? You know what I mean?
Like, would they have become like, I don't know, and I'm saying this not necessarily as an insult to them at all, but would they have become like Green Day or something is what you're asking?
Well, I mean,
because Green Day did have their validity.
Well, but Green, when they first started, but Green Day's also changed over their style of music in the sense that they really don't do the standard attempt at pop punk anymore. It's much more pop. It's much more pop rock than it is really pop.
It's very they definitely went the way of the rock crowd when honestly, when you listen to their stuff, when you truly listen to it, it hasn't really changed a huge amount. I don't necessarily arguing whether or not that is a good or a bad thing is not part of this.
No, I'm just saying that. But they've been able to remain with their changes. They've been able to remain relevant to the time period. And
well, definitely, I would say so. And well, here's the thing:
would Kurt have done that? I mean, I'll give you another. I'll throw out an example.
Yeah.
Has Pearl Jam really been relevant in beyond anybody but Pearl Jam fans since what? No Code, maybe their fourth album.
Look,
I mean, and that's thing is,
okay. So they here's, still have here's a fan my base. My response have, to that, you know, and my response to what's going on with Kurt. And I think we can bring it back to Kurt on more than one occasion. There are many great, great people that have gone way too flippin' early.
Yeah.
But when you're looking at artists, they're purpose is to discuss their worldview
through their art.
Essentially through their art. And so somebody like Kurt Cobain would have continued the narrative of you know what Kurt Cobain would have done right now? He would have been pushing for the he very much would have been pushing for something like for mental health.
Which
advancements,
which would be good,
and a concentration on that, because that is a lot of the things he was dealing with. Those were the biggest things. You have to take it's worth asking the question: what would that person have continued to bring in their opinions of society, and what would they have concentrated on?
Well, but that's and I think what it comes down to is not necessarily that Kurt wouldn't have contributed something, because I agree he would have contributed something.
Yeah,
but I guess it's the way they put some people on one level of like, oh my god, this person was so much to lose in the general discussion of things. Mm-hmm. And then you talk about other people and it's like, you know, you bring up other people that died young, other celebrity, specifically musicians, since that's what we're really focusing on in this part of the discussion. And they don't get – it's like there's almost a rating system like, oh, yeah, okay, that one died, but that one didn't have as much impact. But what if they – you know, who's to say that one didn't have as much impact? Who's to say that they aren't on that equal level? And that's why Kurt Cobain is an example to me that I think he gets elevated above so many other people that maybe – I don't know that he completely deserves being elevated above all the other people as highly as he is. And that's where I think that's where my thing comes in.
I think
it's just, and maybe that's a generational
thing.
I
think the problem here has to do with I will tell you
this. Personal bias.
There's up to a point, yes, but I think more importantly than personal bias, this is something that I tend to see a lot of people do that I like to call out on a pretty regular basis because I don't think it's fair to anybody.
Okay.
Comparing the importance of a musician over the importance of another musician.
Okay, I see what you're saying there.
This is the mistake here is to ask the question whether or not a musician is valid or not because they died, or whether or not a musician's death is valid, period, or how much more they would have brought. It's worth asking the question because it continues to feed a discussion into more important issues. But the problem here is that you cannot compare somebody like the death of Jimi Hendrix to the death of Kurt Cobain. You can't do it. And what's crazy is they died at the same time. Like,
same age,
you cannot compare the death of Janis Joplin to the death of Jim Morrison. You can't do it. It doesn't. The two of them lived.
I would say a good one would
similar
be,
times.
I would say a good one would be Janis Joplin and her name was right on the tip of my tongue. From England. She sang the Back to Black. Seemed like she was drunk or drugged up all the time. Dark hair, 50s style of dress.
Oh, Amy Winehouse?
Yes, that would be a good comparison to Janis Joplin.
In
the sense of both being female icons and all that. But.
Well, I look at somebody like Amy Winehouse, and I see her style was And that's the thing, is they're, these people are perfect storms of, they're perfect storms that are generated by the environments that they were in.
Yeah.
And the fascination with these people has to do with the time that they came out and how much they were not what everybody else was expecting anyone to be at the time.
Trendsetters that they were, the difference
they were.
Makers that they
Cobain
were.
Cobain was a trendsetter.
And very
Joplin
much so.
Joplin was a trendsetter, so. And so was Jim Morrison.
Yes.
The reason why they're important is because they're literally unlike anyone else at the time. Let's consider, you know, what brings them to that you know what's really funny? I can essentially by the rules that you're setting, let's compare those people to people that have continued to survive, that at least lived some semblance of a full life.
Yeah.
I would take somebody like Jim Morrison and try to compare him to Syd Barrett.
Okay.
Are you familiar with Syd Barrett? Do you know who he is?
Floyd, right?
Yes. He was the original singer for Pink Floyd. The guy was out of his... He actually fried himself so bad that he ended up in a mental institution for like 50 years or something like that. He died, I want to say, probably about 10 years ago-ish, give or take. And he was the charisma that Syd Barrett had. And the outward, his outward presentation was probably about as fueled by LSD as Jim Morrison's was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But what couldn't be taken away from either one of those, drugs or not, was their ability to take a look at their environment and communicate about what was there. Like, it comes down to philosophy and poetry. It really does. There is a... Have you ever actually sat and read Jim Morrison's poetry?
Some of it, not a whole lot. It was not
personally,
my cup of tea.
To me, it's about as fascinating as Tupac's poetry, and Tupac had a purpose.
I can understand that.
I'm pulling Tupac in.
That's a relevant person to pull in.
Because the Tupac and
I will say I'm going to argue with you if you try to pull in Biggie. Sorry, I'm West Coast, so little joke. Sorry, move on.
But I would.
California knows how to party.
True, true.
It does. I'm just saying.
All right. So, what I'm getting at is, if you were to look at somebody like Tupac, you look at somebody like Kurt Cobain, you look at somebody like Jim Morrison. All of them had they had something to say that was beyond the personalities that they were putting forth on stage.
Okay, I agree with you on that.
Actually, I take that back. Kurt probably was...
Probably had more than what he was putting out on stage, because he really didn't want to put out much on stage.
It wasn't that he didn't want to put out much on stage. His lyrics were his only form of communication. The guy was as shy on stage as he was off stage.
Yeah, he hated being on stage. He hated the celebrity limelight.
He hated the celebrity... some could argue, let's go ahead and take the controversy and the argument and the conspiracy theory out of it. For the sake of argument, let's just go with what's the most understandable, possibly human outcome. Okay, and it's that he shot himself. The reason why he shot himself was because he was an unregulated, overly medicated,
incorrectly medicated,
very incorrectly medicated person with a lot of mental health issues, and a lot of anxiety, and a lot of stage fright, and all of these things. And he had this fame he didn't want. He just wanted to make music and find a creative outlet. That creative outlet happened to speak to a lot of people, and there was a part of him that was so conflicted with the fact that he was communicating, finding out that he wasn't alone. But then when it came down to the opinions of those around him that were as superficial as the new people that were seeing Nirvana as this powerhouse of music that was not the same as anything else, it messed with him so bad that he made a very ultimate decision, let's say, and it was because he couldn't handle the it's not even pressure. That's not what pressure is. This is mis. This has to do with the dangers of misinterpretation of your art.
Well, oh, you were going to go into that discussion.
Oh yeah, we can.
I would say more than anything, it's just an altering of your reality in a way that you're not ready for, and not prepared for, and not wanting.
I can agree with that very much. I think that's there are so many. This is the funny part about this is it's very open. But
you do still agree that it is worthy of the debate and discussion to say what more could they have done with their lives? Would they have ever been successful in a debating fashion? Not to demean the person,
right,
and treat them badly, but to really think about the fact. Again, Kurt Cobain being the example. If Kurt Cobain doesn't do that, he lives. Does he continue his music career? Does he stop his music career? If he continues his music career, do we then not have Dave Grohl go and do the Foo Fighters as his musical outlet? So we lose that. By losing the Foo Fighters, what other things might we lose?
Right.
Is this kind of butterfly effect situation in this? And whether he would have. I mean, there's that portion of it, but then there's the portion of whether he personally, Kurt Cobain personally, would have made any more art that would have been relevant to other people instead of just maybe relevant to himself.
That's very possible. And whether that matters, could have been also. More. I think that the possibility of what if I were to make a guess of what's going on. First off, when it comes down to the Foo Fighters still would have existed. That was actually a project that Dave was working on.
So you think he still before Dave, Kurt, Dave yeah. would have still done it.
He had been working on it since before that final album was being started.
Yeah,
it was In Utero was done. They were on a quick break because they were done touring. While they were touring, he was recording demos.
And honestly, funny
if I
enough,
remember
I,
correctly,
funny
I
enough,
might
I think
not be correct.
I honestly think Kurt
Grohl
might have,
needed
Kurt might
a
have been
creative
okay
outlet.
For that.
Yeah.
Kurt might have been okay with that. He might not have been closed-minded about having side projects as other lead singers and frontmen have been.
Yes. well done.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you. Tie it to the song we talked about, too. I'm good, huh?
Yeah. Well done. Okay, so quick explanation, if we can, kind of do it. Near the end of Jason Newsted's run with Metallica, he had other creative outlets that he wanted to take because Metallica at the time was a you're all in or you're not in kind of a project, and that had to do with James. He was the mastermind behind that, but
because love is control. He'll die if he lets go.
Right.
yeah.
So basically, with Newsted, the reason why he left was because he did not have the ability to seek a creative outlet that he found satisfactory. James was. You're in this band or you're not in this band, and you cannot do anything other than this band.
That being James Hetfield, not James Me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just for clarity's sake.
So
I'm open to the idea of people being able to be in multiple bands. It's all right.
That's essentially why Newsted left. And Newsted has found and started and ended multiple projects, but he's been able to find his
creative
he's
outlet.
Whether or not it is majorly valid, whether or not he creates some kind of a Foo Fighters-esque level of band, who knows, but he's able to explore those now because he left, and he's proud of the fact that that's the case. He's happy with his life, and he knows he's happy for the rest of the guys continuing on their course. Basically, it's taken the same route as Ron McGovney did. But
so,
that being said,
so wait,
going
the,
back to
is there only one former Metallica member who's not happy? I mean, other than Cliff, because he's not in a state to be really happy or sad. But
jeez.
I mean, but does that mean there's only one former Metallica member that's not happy about the situation?
He wasn't essentially, yeah. There was only one.
Still
he
bitter?
Started an entire, he started, in, no, he's not still bitter.
Oh, he finally gave it up?
Oh, they made peace.
I know that there was discussion.
Around the 30th anniversary.
I know there was discussion. And
we're talking about Dave Mustaine now.
I mean, they did the big four together. They did all that together, but I did.
Oh, but he
I
guessed
he,
it on.
I thought he was still, I thought he was still a little salty about the situation. Even after all of that,
he realized how he's salty about the amount of control that has to go around Metallica's. Like, as soon as Dave left, Dave is somebody that has to have his own thing. I think Dave honestly would have left of his own accord.
eventually anyway. Eventually, because you have control, and he wasn't going to get that.
You
from
have
James
Lars
and,
James that are the dream team of essentially. I mean, no insult to this. Lars and James are the dream team of control freaks.
Yeah.
They know what they want, and they will not budge on that. And that's what's so funny when you hear something like hearing the argument about Metallica being sellouts in the 90s is the most honestly, like, mentally, I cannot process it. It sounds ludicrous to me because those guys, James and Lars, are in complete control of
everything.
The entire situation.
Everything.
Kirk had an interview that he did in Rolling Stone with
Saint
Vincent.
I was wondering if we were going to bring that up at
some
point.
Yeah, we can. Kirk had an interview in Rolling Stone he had with Saint Vincent, who's a fantastic guitarist, by the way. She is insane.
Weird music, but weird music that I say weird in the sense that it's not like most things that you hear on the radio or ever,
right.
Really. But I kind of like
creative.
It.
Super creative. Yeah.
I kind of like
There's
it.
There's this. It's
got that strangeness to it that's just like, it's definitely one of those things that like you... It's
you
one
don't
of,
think you don't know you like it whether
well,
or not
no, it's one of those music
it
that, it's one of those musics that if you like it you probably think that you're a little bit more refined and intelligent than most other people.
Yeah.
Because I think it requires a level of not just accepting something easy to interpret.
Yeah.
It definitely has more layers to it, and it does give you a little sense of I'm smarter than most people kind of thing.
Yeah.
But not saying that you are, it just makes you feel that way.
Right.
But it's a different level of music. I have not, however, seen the guitar skills to be able to corroborate your statement on that. But
yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me because the music has definitely got a depth to it that you don't expect.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, what the conversation that I'm talking about, the interview I'm talking about, was Kirk.
Yes.
Sorry,
we have Kirk Hammett and Kurt Cobain.
Right.
That's K-U-R-T Cobain, K-I-R-K Hammett, like Captain Kirk Hammett.
Captain Kirk Hammett. But yeah, Kirk was very vocal about the fact that he is far more educated musically than everybody thinks. Like they think Kirk Hammett is speed picking on the 12th fret and wah pedal. Like that's all they think he is.
Basically he learned some cool little guitar tricks from Joe Satriani when he was a student of Joe Satriani.
Right.
And there you go. He just does all these cool little guitar tricks and whatnot.
But that guy went far beyond that. He actually learned a lot about many different styles, and he does what he can. He's been fighting for years to try to get something that is out of that box of his lead playing, and every once in a while he gets a thing in. Every once in a while there's something that's just a little weird
if actually you look at the songwriting credits on the Load and Reload album, you see a lot more songwriting credits from Kirk Hammett on those albums. And if you listen to those songs, those are the ones that have kind of the more bluesy riffs in them.
Yeah.
Because Kirk is very much a fan of blues music and blues guitar playing.
Yeah.
And you can see anything that that hops up into a minor or major pentatonic scale.
Yeah.
in the riff, not necessarily in the solos, but in the riff itself.
Yeah.
He's had a hand in those riffs.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Cool.
He's had a hand in those. Just it's a fun little exercise, cuz normally almost all Metallica songs are Hetfield Ulrich.
Yeah.
You see a few that have Hammett in there, and especially a couple more in the Load and Reload sessions, and if you kind of listen, you can almost hear where his influence is, cuz he has more of that bluesy element in what he does.
It's really funny too, but so one of the things that he states is that a lot of his creativity is stifled by what he calls the tone police.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and the reason why is because, you know, he'll be like, hey, I want to put in this extra little thing here, do this one weird deal
here. That doesn't sound like Metallica.
That doesn't sound like us. No, we can't do that. And he's, you know, don't get me wrong, the guy's, you know, helped build an empire on that.
Well, I mean, I admit I feel some sadness.
It's a compromise that he has to make in his commercially successful creative outlets.
Well, and that's the thing is, I understand this. I understand the sadness that he has that he can't get all of his creativity out. He can go and deal with that sadness while sitting on his giant piles of money. Because that's really as far as my sympathy goes. It's like, I get it, dude. You want to have this. You want to have other creative outlets, and that's awesome for you. But like, you know, you have money and lots of it. So I mean, just you can play your creative outlet stuff whenever you want to. Why does it have to be in an album, on a record, on a this and that? Just play that stuff and have fun with it. I said stuff. I wanted to say another word. You were lucky I didn't. Just play that stuff and have fun with it while you light your cigar with a $100 bill. I mean, seriously, man.
You know what? He may have more money than he needs to than he is ever going to need, but that's kind of beside the point. Like, here's the thing. That interview makes me want to know, what does this guy know? What is this guy writing in his home studio that's never coming out commercially?
Well, that's
because you know he's got to have a vault worth of stuff at this point.
He had a phone that he lost.
Oh, that's right. He lost a.
He had a phone. He had a phone that had like hundreds
of riffs.
Yeah, he had hundreds of riffs on his phone, and he lost it, and so he really didn't have much to bring to the table for the most recent album. Most recent album was all Hetfield stuff that was Hetfield and Ulrich stuff that they brought to the table.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's really funny. Speaking of writing, looking at this creativity stifling and stuff that they're talking about.
Yeah.
I am blown out by the fact that he has to put that out there. He has to say that, especially being the fact that the biggest hit they've ever had, the main riff that carries that entire song, was written by Kirk.
Yeah.
And he wrote the riff to Enter Sandman. It's his riff that carries that whole thing.
And it's in a pentatonic scale.
And yeah. It's a
pentatonic scale.
Yeah, it's a pentatonic scale guitar riff written at 120 BPM. It is a dance hit.
Yeah,
technically speaking.
Well, he wrote a version of the riff and then it kind of got altered by Lars, but still.
Yeah.
Still. Anyway, we strayed from the point, but that's all right.
We did. Okay, so going back to the case of
Cobain.
The case of Cobain, and let's explore Cobain and Dave Grohl for a bit. One of the things that we were talking about is I honestly think that Cobain's death really didn't stop these guys from being as
prolific as they were.
I think what would have happened is Cobain would have branched off, like, this is my guess as to what would have happened. I think Cobain would have branched off and talked about mental health with the same conviction and the same tenacity eventually, because he would end up probably around his 30s. He possibly may have had another overdose. Again, this is a guess,
yeah.
But I think he would have had some kind of
moment of revelation.
Yeah, some kind of reckoning or moment of revelation where he would refocus his life to, and whether or not he continued to make music is one thing.
Well, and again, the flip
side.
But
I think he would have spoken about mental health and that kind of situation with as much tenacity as Henry Rollins speaks about politics.
And the flip side of what my opinion is, or my thought has been about what more would he have given us? He could have given a lot more to society as far as his creativity and music.
Yeah.
We could have had three or four more albums of Nirvana that were that showed an evolution in musical style that still had that same rough feeling to it,
yeah,
but evolved a little bit with the times and was able to still capture the zeitgeist of what was going on, which is kind of what he's most famous for. He was a voice of a generation of people. Not, interestingly enough, not our generation. He was a Gen X voice.
Yeah.
But the way he did that then, he could have kept that thing going and still been a voice for the people. Still been completely and utterly relevant. Hell, he could be on something like a TV show like The Voice. At this point in time,
that's possible. I don't think he would have been
America's
super,
Got Talent or something.
Yeah,
I don't
think he would have been super into it.
You never know what would have happened.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure. But he wasn't an anti-establishment person. He was an anti-oppression person.
Yeah,
he was against oppression, not any of this other stuff. Like this is the guy that cut his teeth on you know, Joe Strummer and John Lennon and. You know, like, this is, he got, his philosophy on life was based on a lot of, Neil Young, another one. Like,
yeah.
These people that he trained his life philosophy with, they all are very, they're about personal freedom. They're about expression. He just wanted to follow that he wanted to follow that philosophy, but when it came down to the pressures of being misinterpreted as some kind of commercial pop powerhouse, that was something that was completely outside of his.
Yeah.
It was outside of his realm of thinking. He couldn't even process that. It didn't make any sense to him. He didn't understand why he was being vilified so much.
I get all that, and I'm not necessarily worried about the discussion of what may or may not have led to his suicide, or however anybody wants to interpret what actually happened to him.
Yeah.
But
sorry, I apologize for going on that.
I'm just more thinking of what more he may have been able to bring artistically. And again, even if he wasn't able to bring anything artistically more to the table, that's not to demean a human life in any way, shape, or form. And I don't want anybody to think I'm demeaning a human life in that way.
No.
I'm just saying the way that the public responds to the death of some of these artists.
Yeah.
And how they respond to the death of some, but don't respond to the death of others. Like outside the – Cliff Burton was kind of the impetus of – since we talked about him. Outside of the metal community, there's nobody else who really cared about the death of Cliff Burton. It was just a metal community thing.
Right.
And I see him as – I see his death being more important than just somebody within the metal community.
Right.
Because of the – again, the person that he was, mm-hmm. and the possible artistic talent he had yet to give. And that's I don't want to demean what people feel about Kurt Cobain and what – I just sometimes think that certain people, for whatever reason, are by the general public elevated more when they have their deaths than what other people are. And it's like Elvis being a prime example, whether you believe he's dead or not, the world is supposed to accept the fact that he's dead. And that's, I don't see any reason why not to think he's dead, but really, how much did we lose from Elvis dying? We lost a fat guy in a jumpsuit performing songs that he didn't even write. That he'd been performing for a long time. So what we lost was a performer. We didn't lose a songwriter or a musical genius. We lost a great performer. Now, I'm saying this as an Elvis fan, mm-hmm. but that's one way to interpret the fact that he didn't technically write the majority of his hit songs. He has writing credit on them, but other people wrote those songs. He just performed them. Now, as a performer, he was amazing. He was able to capture people when he was doing his performance. But did we lose somebody that was that big of a impact on songwriting, on the creation of the art? That can be, like you say, it's something that could be debated, something that could be talked about.
Well, I would, okay, here's,
and that's, you know,
my argument on that would be, in order to compare Elvis to other musicians and songwriters is the same way as comparing actors and writers.
Yeah, it's apples, because apples to oranges.
Yeah, it totally is. Elvis was a performer.
He was.
That's like losing a great Broadway actor young.
Yeah. Well, but Elvis wasn't that young. He was he was up in
the
years.
No, he wasn't that. Was he in his 40s?
He wasn't even exactly 50. How old he was.
I want to say he was like in his mid 40s, cuz he was just pop full of medication. He had as much medication as Ozzy Osbourne had when he was in his 50s. Coursing through his system. But to compare Elvis's importance against another songwriter, I don't think is necessarily fair.
42.
Yep, I knew he was young. He was young, but that was it. That's what,
42?
Yeah.
Damn.
Did you ever see?
I'm not that far away from that, man.
Did you ever see Keith Moon? And what he looked like before he died?
No.
He looked like he was 38 years old.
But he was like in his 20s.
Yes, he died in his 20s. Drugs do a lot to people.
Drugs,
man,
are bad, children. Also, adults, drugs are bad.
Yep.
Don't do drugs unless they're the ones that the doctor prescribed for you and you actually need them to live.
Well, that's what the... Okay.
Otherwise,
well,
don't do drugs.
I'm not going to get into that because, I mean, that's what all the doctors told Elvis, to take all those drugs. That was the issue. As a matter of fact,
sure,
that's what killed Keith
doctors.
Moon, too. Keith Moon was a combination of drinking and actually taking a supplement to curb his drinking at the same time.
That was just bad decision making. Jesus. Okay. Just.
So, yeah.
Some drugs are good, but don't take drugs. Damn it. So difficult.
I think this is a good spot to call it. That's a great spot.
Thank you. All right. Well, I guess we're done for the day.
Yeah.
Mike is saying we're done. He wants me to stop talking to people about drugs. Thank you for listening. Glad we could be back after 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Hopefully we won't have to take a break like this again. No more throwing up of people, because throwing up is bad.
Yeah, throwing up is bad.
Throwing up is very bad. Mm-hmm. Anyway, not sure what we'll talk to you guys about next week, but I do know holidays are in full swing. We just had Halloween.
Starting to kick in, man.
We have Thanksgiving coming up. Maybe I'll talk about how I do turkey dinner, because turkey dinner is important.
Yeah.
Like bomb-ass turkey.
Oh, yeah,
dude.
That's a great one.
Have you ever
one.
Had my turkey before?
No, sir, I do not believe
You've
so.
You've not had my turkey before? Uh-uh. My turkey requires
this
a lot of work.
Before. Okay.
Actually, the first time I did this turkey,
uh-huh.
we did pre-Thanksgiving. 2 weeks ahead of Thanksgiving.
So
I knew that I could make the turkey
recipe.
Right.
Nice.
I wanted to try I was trying a recipe. It's actually a recipe by my favorite Food Network chef.
Okay.
I wanted to try the recipe and make sure it worked, make sure I was able to get it to work properly.
Okay.
And I invited, I actually invited our website designer, Rob.
Nice.
Over, because best friend,
yeah.
kid after him, great guy. I invited him over for our first ever pre-Thanksgiving,
because mm-hmm.
this is the first Thanksgiving that myself and my wife were going to host as adults. Mm-hmm. I know she knew how to make all the other stuff. Like, she makes giblet gravy and, like, real giblet gravy.
Dude, you're making me hungry, man.
Welcome to my existence. I'm always hungry. I'm fat. Anyway, but we invited him over for our first ever pre-Thanksgiving. Then for a couple of years, when he still lived local, we made it a tradition to do a pre-Thanksgiving with him.
Cool.
And then once he moved away, I'm not going to do that anymore when he's moved away. I would be nice to have turkey multiple times, but... Last year, actually, I had 3 turkeys.
Dang.
Yeah, 3 turkeys.
I guess practice makes perfect,
Between
huh?
Halloween and Christmas, we had 3 turkeys. No, it was just about, we got turkeys at a really cheap price. Every time I was in a store, there was like a deal for a turkey, so I was just like, I have freezer room. I'll get another turkey. And I perfected my turkey method to this point, where like, you know, like when you're first doing a recipe, you have to get measurements and you measure everything out real careful and whatnot. And
yeah, totally.
Make sure you get all of the right things. No, not now. Now it's like, cool, I'm making the stuff for the turkey. Start day ahead of time. Start making all the stuff I need to. It's just boom, 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 boom. I'll add this time. That might make the flavor a little different. All right. And it turns out perfect every time.
Nice.
Every time.
Nice.
All right. So now that you all are hungry, go get something to eat and we'll talk to you next week. Although... I've forgotten something. We took time off and now I'm forgetting things.
What are you forgetting?
Mike, where can people listen to us?
Oh, well, you can listen to us at the website, the Zenio Clark.
Don't mark it. You're not going to edit this
take
out.
Take a week off. And now...
Everything's going wrong. It's chaos.
All right.
Cats and dogs sleeping with each other.
All right.
Movie reference.
You could see us at the Zenial Chronicle, or hear us at the ZenialChronicles.com or ZenCron.com if you don't want to type that much. Speaking of ZenCron, you could follow us on Facebook. You could follow us on Twitter. And check us out on YouTube.
Please.
Our entire archive of all of our episodes are on our YouTube page. So if you're listening to us on YouTube or you search for the Zenial Chronicles on YouTube, make sure to click the subscribe button and click the bell icon so when a new episode comes up, you can hear us.
Quick funny story.
What's up?
Because I will admit that... you know, it's always nice to up our subscriber numbers. So my 3 children who have their own tablets and their own YouTube accounts and their own Google accounts, their own YouTube accounts, because, you know, they get emails, they get stuff, they want to do things on their tablets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had all 3 of their YouTube accounts subscribe to the podcast and click the bell thingies. And so my son comes down after we posted the video last week.
Yeah.
My son comes downstairs from watching his tablet. He goes, Dad, what? I saw you on YouTube, Dad. Oh, you saw my video? Yeah, Dad. Where was I? Up in your room. Yeah, I was up in my room. I saw you on YouTube. Isn't that cool? Yeah. Like, hell yeah, it's cool.
It's great.
You get to see my face.
Yep.
That's all you're going to see, because you don't want to see the rest. Anyway.
Okay.
Follow us. Listen to us. Wait, there's other places too, right?
We're on TuneIn. We're on Google.
Yeah. What's the other one?
You can
Spotify.
Spotify, yes.
So please, listen, like wherever you can like us, follow, and we'll talk again next week.
You guys have a good one.
Thank you for tuning in, friends. The journey continues next week.